Good evening, ladies, gentlemen, colleagues, students, and people who come from outside the university. It is my very great pleasure to welcome Professor Anne Lawrence here to do the first of the papers in Sunderland of the Before the Depression Research Project. A very warm welcome. We'll come back to a title in a minute. Right, this project, which many of you know, but some do not, so forgive me for telling you that which you already know, is a three-year research project, which is an excellent collaboration between the two universities of Sunderland and Northumbria. It has only fairly recently begun, so this is the first of the Sunderland events, and it's led by Professor Richard Terry, Professor Stuart Sim, and also Professor Alan Ingram, who's over there, and Clark Lawler. Those are the key people, and there are others involved. Our research assistant, also involved, and PhD student in both institutions. So it's quite a large project altogether. What it will do is raise the profile of two very distinguished departments who already have considerable reputation, and we hope the outcomes of this will raise the profile even further. In raising the profile, what will be the outcomes? Not only a series of lectures, of which you've obviously seen the flyer on all the lectures, but there will be a major conference in the summer of 2008, and this will be accompanied by an exhibition which will be held at the Shipley Art Gallery. There will also be a number of publications, both collaborative and single, which will come out of this. So it is a major, major undertaking. So we're delighted to be working with you at Northumbria. We're delighted that so many people who are outside universities, both of them, have come to join us this evening, and you will hope we will stay with us for the rest of the series. Now, Professor Anne Lawrence, who comes from the Open University and is a long-standing colleague of Stuart's. Stuart, before he came to us some 15 years ago, worked at the Open University as well. But I understand that Anne is rather ingeniously going to be crossing the boundaries between literature, history, and other visual material, which is actually, in a sense, at the heart of what this project's about. Depression and the mental world of early modern women. The whole issue of before depression, just to sum up, is actually to examine what depression meant, how it was identified, how it is portrayed in literature and artistic material, and such medical records as exist before it was formally classified, which, as many of you know, were great attempts to classify this from the 1820s and onwards. But we are in early modern England, and may I have the pleasure of introducing you to Professor Anne Lawrence, and we look forward to hearing your talk.
Thank you.
At the view of the ships outside. However, we're going to talk about depression this evening. As those of you who've been thinking about depression over previous months and years will know, there's a good deal of discussion amongst historians and students of literature and other disciplines about whether it's appropriate to use modern medical terminology to describe conditions of people in the past. So this lecture starts with two difficult premises. The first is one that historians feel rather uncomfortable with, that is to say, discussing a condition, depression, for which there was no name in the early modern period. And I should say I'm defining early modern as roughly 1500 to 1800, but I'll be talking primarily about the 17th century. The Oxford English Dictionary, such a reliable source for these matters, finds the word depression used for the first time in the sense of a psychological condition in 1905. Before then, it chiefly used to mean a declivity in the ground or rather than a lowering of the spirits. The second difficult premise is one that is that one of the cardinal crimes that a physician can commit is to try to diagnose somebody who they haven't actually seen. And I should say that in the 17th and 18th centuries, people had no such inhibitions, and some physicians conducted a large part of their practices by correspondence. And in a sense, we're trying to diagnose people at a distance by interpreting descriptions of mental and physical states of 350 years ago, particularly as the descriptions that we have were intended largely for completely different purposes. But in defiance of these caveats, what I want to do is to look at some of the evidence for depression in early modern England, especially amongst women. So what I hope to do this evening is to say something about the mental and physical worlds of the period, how diseases were conceptualised, and especially the physician's medical philosophy of humoral pathology and women's health and disease. And then I want to talk about some of the evidence for depression in the period, and the centrality of religion. And this is where women's spiritual autobiographies particularly come in. And to conclude with some general remarks about the connection between these ideas and today. So I'll start by saying something about the mental and physical world of the period. It's especially important, I think, to recognise that concepts of health and disease were quite different. I mean, let me give you an example. We regard infestations of worms, fleas, nits, bedbugs and what have you as disgusting, but actually very large numbers of people in the 16th and 17th century lived with these companions all their lives. We've identified a set of nutritional disorders that we take care to avoid. We know that the remedies are to eat roughage and to take sufficient vitamins C and D, for example. And the causes of constipation, scurvy and rickets, which are all very common conditions, were considered to be quite different and unavoidable. I mean, scurvy was believed to be an infectious disease. I mean, we know that cleanliness, both of our persons and our drinking water, are terribly important to maintaining good health. So apart from the kind of preventative and public health measures that we're used to, modern scientific medicine, I put scare quotes around scientific, involves making careful diagnoses, building up a picture of symptoms, relating them to the pathology of known conditions. And modern medicine relies on testing physical responses such as blood pressure and chemical reactions in blood, urine and so on. 17th century physicians did take blood and urine samples, but as diagnostic tools they were pretty useless, except for the most basic characteristics such as colour, smell and taste, and I understand the urine of diabetics tastes sweet. And the medical philosophies with which these physicians worked in the 17th century were very different from ours. So I want to talk a little bit about how they conceptualised disease. The philosophy, humoral pathology, which guided most physicians, did also permeate everyday language. And I mean, I think perhaps a modern parallel might be talking about being driven mad by something that annoys us, or something spreading like the plague. And you know, I'm sure you'll remember Prince Charles talking about buildings being monstrous carbuncles. I mean, these are all medical metaphors. But humoral pathology, which guided early modern physicians' work, was a system that was used to describe the characteristics of healthy people as well as the sick. And it was based on the idea that within everybody there were four humours, each with different characteristics. Ooh, this has turned into something different from what I had. The four humours are blood, phlegm, colour, and melancholy. They were also associated with the elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And some practitioners took seriously account of astrological forces. This isn't quite as strange as it might seem, because alchemy was where serious chemical research took place, and this is the period when the first so-called chemical medicines came into use. The humours had many other characteristics, but since people found it hard to agree on what they were, I think we'll move swiftly on. I think I should at this point emphasise that although melancholy shares many characteristics with depression, it isn't exactly the same. Apart from anything else, I mean, modern diagnostic techniques which have associated depression with chemical imbalance were, of course, completely impossible to carry out in the 17th century. Illness was understood to be caused by an imbalance in the humours, but the balance for men and women were different. Women were considered to be colder and moister than men. So intrinsically, they were phlegmatic, while men were choleric. You can see male kind of testosterone choleric drive. The seat of women's cold moistness was taken to be the womb. So medical diagnosis was directed to trying to establish which humours were out of balance. And in looking at imbalances, psychological states were considered in the same register as physical ones, and not just psychological states, the state of your soul came into this. As diagnosis was concerned with identifying imbalances, treatments were concerned with trying to correct them. Not much medical treatment had much effect, but diet was considered to be a very important part of treatment on a kind of continuum with drugs and externally applied poultices and ointments and what have you. A late 16th century treatise on melancholy lists the foodstuffs which engendered melancholy humours and should be avoided. And the list is enormous. I mean, beet, cabbage, raw quinces, medlars, dates, olives, chestnuts, wheat bread, bag pudding, fritters, pancakes, pulses, meat of all sorts, liver, kidney, boar, venison, waterfowl. The bewildering list of birds that anybody disposed to melancholy shouldn't eat. Sparrows, field fares, thrushes, doves, quail, so on. They couldn't eat peacocks or porpoises, deep sea fish such as eels, no milk products, fish roe, no red wine, and no cloudy beer or cider. And not much left for the melancholic to eat. They could eat shellfish, especially oysters, freshwater fish and honey. That seemed to be about the sum of it. I mean, I think what this list really brings home is the powerlessness of the physician and the patient. I want again to emphasise that this pathology, this way of thinking about disease, made little distinction between mental or psychological symptoms and physical symptoms. Melancholy wasn't just a humour, it was a state of the soul described in huge detail in Robert Burton's famous work, The Anatomy of Melancholy, published in 1621. And it had strong manifestations in Elizabethan literature, whose pictorial embodiment you see in this marvellous miniature by Nicholas Hilliard of around 1588. Melancholy became fashionable as a sign of nobility of soul and refined sensibility. At the other end of the spectrum, this picture comes from a popular ballad that mocked madness. The mad were often shown as being very scantily clad, And this is a bedlamite of the 1690s. You'll notice that I've kind of slid into equating melancholy with depression. And certainly in physicians' accounts, it contains some of the same ingredients. But I think one should be very cautious about using the terms interchangeably. The fashionable melancholy of the poets was a far cry from the condition we regard as an illness. But if melancholy was the chosen term of the physician, the chosen term of the clergy was despair. Let me say something now about women's health and disease. The conceptual world is a very difficult one to enter, but at its bottom was the belief that women were inferior intellectually, physically, and psychologically. One of the few respects in which they were considered not to be inferior was spiritually, the importance of biblical women, chief of whom, of course, was the Virgin Mary, and her female relations of women such as Martha and Mary Magdalene, Old Testament women Ruth, Sarah, Hagar, and of female Catholic saints, even in the Protestant world of 17th century England, emphasised that women were spiritual beings. Though, in fact, classical debates about whether women had a soul did continue in the 17th century. The place where Protestant, and in particular Puritan women's spirituality was best celebrated was in funeral sermons for godly women. These very often had biographies attached to them. I'll say something about this in a moment. Women's health was considered to be completely bound up with their reproductive functions. I mean, I'm sure you know that the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb. And medical texts dealt very extensively with women's reproductive functions, with menstruation and childbearing and its complications. And the complications were manifold. First, many women had rickets caused by, I can't remember whether it's a vitamin A deficiency or a vitamin D deficiency, and had deformed pelvises. So complications of obstructed pregnancy were very much more common than they are today. Second, we know that if you survive your first pregnancy, you're probably okay, but after the fifth pregnancy, complications begin to increase. All but the most aristocratic women married in their mid-20s or thereabouts. I mean, the age of marriage in England was really quite late. So a woman might expect to have about 8 pregnancies during her reproductive life, and breastfeeding spaced them out to about every 2 years or so. I mean, these figures are very well established. Of those 8 pregnancies, women might expect to see 4 or 5 children reach adulthood. So as you can see, a significant number of all pregnancies were high risk. Interval when women might have low risk pregnancies was quite small. Aristocratic women were considerably worse off, though they were in generally better health to start with than lower class women. Firstly, they married younger. Although marriages were sometimes contracted in the early teens for dynastic purposes, parents had quite a realistic view of what constituted married life, so couples didn't normally take up residence together until their late teens. Nevertheless, aristocratic women's childbearing years started much younger than those of plebeian women. And because they generally didn't breastfeed, their pregnancies were much closer together. There's no doubt that many women were terrified of childbirth, especially if they had a history of difficult deliveries. Mary Carey wrote a book of meditations in the apprehension that she would die giving birth to her fourth child in the 1650s. And an anonymous woman wrote in the late 17th century of how, when she was pregnant, I was very distressed as to my bodily health, and as my time drew near, I had reason to conjecture that I was with twins, which occasioned much fear in me, thinking that, upon the bearing of one child, if it should be told me that I had another to bear immediately, it would be much more terrible to me than death. And in fact, she had reason to be anxious, for her child was born dead. And the next time she fell pregnant, I fell under such a terror and consternation as was like to sink me to death. Fortunately, this time she had an easy and safe delivery. Many women were intensely anxious at the prospect of labour. Would you like a swig of my water? Back to women's labour. And many women were justifiably very, very anxious. Elizabeth, Countess of Bridgewater, writing in the 1640s, wrote a number of prayers on pregnancy and on labour and at the birth of her children. One of them goes as follows: I beg of thee to have compassion on me in the great pain I am to feel. She had already had two children. In the bringing forth of this my child. When that I come to the cruel groves of labour, in this my travail give me patience, give me no untimely birth. Another prayer for when she was in labour asked God to bring me out of this my extremity and fill my mouth with honour and praise to thee, that I may see my dear child without any deformity. The helplessness of midwives and doctors is indicated in her prayer for when I continued with child after I thought I should have fallen in labour. And another woman, Elizabeth Viscountess Mordaunt, wrote a whole series of prayers of thanksgiving for the safe delivery of her children born in the 1660s and 1670s. I've said something about the reasons why childbirth was likely to be more difficult for women than it is for women nowadays. And there wasn't much in the way of effective pain relief. Mrs. Alice Thornton, who had been very ill after several of her pregnancies, wrote of the birth of her fifth child in the 1650s, I was upon the rack in bearing my child with such exquisite torment as if each limb were divided from other. This labour lasted only 2 hours, but the child was born feet first and dead. Of her 9 full-term pregnancies, only 3 children survived for more than a few weeks. It was usually agreed that women in childbed should be governed according to their respective constitutions, and that labouring women required different treatment from more delicate ladies of quality. I've suggested some reasons why this might actually have had some substance. I mean, many women suffered prolonged ill health after childbirth. Mrs. Elizabeth Walker wrote of how, after giving birth in 1660 to her 8th child, a stillborn son, I fell into melancholy, which much disturbed me with vapours, and was very ill. Alice Thornton suffered fits, fevers, sweats, faintings, lost hair and fingernail, her teeth became loose. And after her later pregnancies, she really never had a day's good health. I don't I mean, she wrote a very long, elaborate account of this. I don't think one can construe it just as the complaints of an unhappy woman. Some modern writers have associated postpartum depressions with the increasing number of hospital births. But since the 1850s, when records of this kind of condition first started to be kept, the incidence has remained fairly constant, and these are the figures. In the mid-17th century, the physician Charles Lepoix noticed that some women developed mental disorders during childbirth, or delirium immediately after childbirth. The delirium could have been the consequence of puerperal fever, and attributed these to dark humours. References to mild postpartum depression started to appear in the medical literature in the early 19th century. It's difficult not to see something of these conditions in these descriptions from the 1650s. About some 9 years ago, at the birth of a child, I had very great temptations of destroying myself, and have oftentimes a knife put into my hand to do it, so that I durst not be left by myself alone. And another woman, I had temptation by Satan to drown myself in a pond near Leeds in Yorkshire, whither the devil had led me, and I was by him drawn out thither, and came to the pond side, but by the providence of God, having a great love to a young infant I had then, I took that child in my arms, and when I came to the place I looked upon the child and considered myself, what shall I destroy myself and my poor child? Melancholy was the commonest postpartum condition that physicians identified. But Mrs. Elizabeth Walker's daughter was seized by a state which took her head and deprived her of her understanding. Sometimes, of course, these states were exacerbated by grief because of the deaths of children or stillbirths. What I want to do now is to talk a bit about some of this evidence for depression or melancholy in the mental worlds of these people. I've given you some quotations of women writing about their experiences, and I want to explore this a bit more. We know a good deal about men's ideas about women's diseases from medical writings. One very important source is popular handbooks with titles such as A Rich Closet of Physical Secrets, The Queen's Closet Opened, The Accomplished Lady's Rich Closet of Rarities, the Gentlewoman's Closet Unlocked, and so on and so on. Many of them were primarily recipe books for medicines, and like Sir Kenelm Digby's well-known work, also contained recipes for preserving, making crystallized violets, cordials, and remedies both internal and external. But they also contained descriptions such as this of melancholy of the mind. You can see here how important the womb was taken to be, and also, again, that the mind and body are not taken to be separate. And from the same work, this is from A Sick Man's Rare Jewel of 1674, you can see the same mixture of physical and psychological symptoms. Few of these medical works made any claims to originality, but the reason that unlocking or exposing secrets appears so often is that learned physicians' texts by authors such as Thomas Willis, Theodore de Mayerne, and Thomas Sydenham were normally published in Latin. Occasionally there were kind of abbreviated English versions published as well. Another very well-known work, John Peach's General Treatise of the Diseases of Maids, Big-Bellied Women, Childbed Women and Widows, published in 1696, acknowledged a debt to Rodericus, a Castro and others that have wrote well of women's diseases. So I mean, these are quite derivative works. He opined that melancholy befalls virgins, widows and barren women oftener than other women. And one of the reasons he offered was that the nature of a woman was tender and the mind easily dejected. And he produced a great string of symptoms. I mean, some of them were things like, you know, the texture of a woman's skin, as well as cogitation, suspicion, shamefacedness, dejection of the mind, disturbed sleep, frightful dreams, hot pulsating breast palpitations, thirst, wakefulness, despair, weeping and sorrow. What he described as melancholy, madness, delirium and epilepsy of women in childbed was attributed to too great an evacuation of blood or to too small an evacuation. So this, you know, was a good let out for not being able to cure the disease anyway. He noted a report of a very beautiful lady who after delivery fell melancholy and was mad for a month, but by the use of a few medicines recovered her senses. And another of a physician who had often cured a Dutch merchant's wife who was frequently distracted after delivery. And he described this melancholy as a cold disorder, a delirium without fever, delirium being an alienation of the mind, and asserted that its cause was a melancholy humour possessing the seat of the mind. And he contrasted this with madness, which was a more outrageous and hot disorder. We're fortunate in having a number of physicians' case notes. Amongst them are those of John Simcotts, a Bedfordshire physician, the voluminous writings of Richard Napier, who also lived in Bedfordshire, and the casebook of John Westover, a physician at Wedmore in Somerset. Napier recorded some 1,200 cases of mental disorder involving women and about 750 of men. However, it's difficult to associate this completely with the known gender difference in the incidence of mental illness because more women than men consulted Napier for physical ailments, and quite a lot of the consultations, as far as one can tell from his notes, were somebody saying, you know, coming in with a bad foot and saying, oh, and by the way, I'm distracted in the head. Westover had a relatively small practice, and most of his cases were severely practical. A sore mouth, the measles, a dislocated shoulder, dressings for wounds, fevers, worms, the itch, that kind of thing. But in 1686, he noted that he'd prescribed two potions of senna and jalap for a woman's melancholy and told her that her distemper proceeded from melancholy. I mean, so it was the distemper, really, that he was treating. And he'd give her pills and other medicine for the melancholy. Purges seem to have been one of the most popular remedies for melancholy. Interestingly enough, most of Westover's patients who came to him complaining of melancholy moods, as it were women, but there weren't very many of them amongst the whole. I want to turn now to more kind of biographical sources, to women themselves rather than to people observing women. Unfortunately, letters are generally not a very good source because, apart from anything else, for much of the 17th century, women's letters are not very extensive. Many, of course, haven't survived. But writing a letter wasn't a thing to do lightly when postage was expensive and it was paid by the recipient rather than the sender. And writing a letter was a labour to which many women were not equal, and letters tended to be concerned with business matters rather than with the writer's interior life. It's in the 18th century that we begin to get physicians' diagnostic and treatment letters. As I mentioned before, that physicians conducting their practice by correspondence. There was one particularly famous 18th century physician called George Cheyne, who as it were, was the fancy London physician, providing metropolitan medicine for country women. There are... I want to turn now to looking at some biographical accounts of women. I mentioned biographies attached to funeral sermons earlier. The purpose of these godly lives that are attached to funeral sermons was really explicitly didactic, and I mean, sometimes publishing funeral sermons was a bit of a career move for a clergyman, but actually a well-known kind of journalist called Samuel Clarke used to publish collections of these biographies separated from the sermons. There's one called Lives of Sundry Eminent Persons in the Later Age, and he illustrated these lives with portraits. And some of the people, I have no idea how he knew what they looked like. This was actually for his wife. Where women's mental states are referred to in these accounts, it's chiefly for the purpose of saying how they overcame their grief or despair. This is another of the portraits. Lady Mary Vere looks extraordinarily old-fashionedly dressed for somebody who died in 1671. I mean, it looks more like 1571, so I suspect that maybe the print, the woodcut's been borrowed from something else. But there are, in fact, apart from these biographical sources, a few autobiographical accounts. These were written because of the growing discipline of spiritual accounting. The godly believer wanted to account for her actions before God, and so did so on paper. There are some very well-known ones, like the autobiography of Mary Rich, Countess of Warwick, and some of the women whose words I've already quoted. But these were all written by elite women within a very specific discipline. I mean, there were in fact some guidance manuals for how to do a spiritual autobiography. What I want to look at is something slightly different, a different kind of autobiography. During the 1640s and 50s, the period of the Civil War and Commonwealth, there was a tremendous rise in the number of radical religious sects. Freed from the constraints of press censorship and conformity imposed by the Church of England, which had collapsed in 1640, these sects set up all over the place. And some of them required postulants as a condition of entry to give an account of their spiritual journey as a test of whether they were ready to join the congregation, whether they were worthy to join the congregation. Inevitably, there's something slightly stilted about these accounts because they had to fit into a rhetorical formula that took the believer through her childhood to her religious doubts with her final... with the kind of denouement was the final discovery of the saving power of God's grace. And two ministers made collections of these testimonies which had been spoken in their own congregations. It's clear that each of them, in writing them down, moulded them into a rhetorical framework to bring out the best exemplary elements. Nevertheless, there was quite a lot of room for individuality. And it's in these accounts that I think we come near to finding something of the mental world of non-elite women. One collection was made by John Rogers, who, he was an Englishman who had a congregation in Dublin. He was sent to Ireland shortly after the Cromwellian invasion, and his congregation was essentially expatriate English men and women there. And he published his collection in 1653. He was quite unusual amongst ministers in believing that women had an important role in the congregation. He wrote, "Though there is a civil subjection to men in their economical relations, there is not any servile subjection due to them, whereby poor souls are enslaved and kept under bondage from doing their duty to God or taking Christian liberty to do the things of God." He balked at letting women preach, but he did believe that women should be allowed to speak in church. He recorded 38 testimonies, of which 17 were women's, and he described the process of their being given, that members of the congregation should hold out their experiences to others, yea, in the open congregations, and then we shall show you the reasons. Everyone to be admitted gives out some experimental evidence of the work of grace upon his soul, for the church to be the judge of, whereby he or she is convinced that he is regenerate and received of God. And he set out the kind of formula that the speaker was supposed to follow. He took down quite a lot of these testimonies verbatim, but he also, he didn't take down every single one. He refers to some of them being of inferior glory. But he particularly liked testimonies that had visions in them, and he recorded this enormous length testimony from a woman called Elizabeth Avery, who went into a trance and heard voices. But what we find in these testimonies is women describing the most testing times of their lives. Frances Curtis reported that, having been stripped of her possessions, "I heard my husband was killed by the rebels, which I feared was by my sins, and so my troubles were renewed. And then the enemies came upon us, the cannon bullets flew over my head, and in a few days I was turned out of doors with my child in my arms. I cannot express what God hath done for me in saving my life and my husband's, in hearing my prayers and tears, and now in satisfying my soul with himself." Another woman reported, "I've been infinitely troubled by my marriage to my second husband and have been afflicted in conscience about it much." And quite brave to stand up in church and say that. Elizabeth Avery had great afflictions, and amongst others by the loss of my children, "God's rod was laid heavy upon me, inasmuch that he struck three of them together, and one child above all, a most sweet child, and one that I least thought of them all would have died, was very ill. And later, God tried me and took away another child from me." Elizabeth Chambers told a similar story. "Yea, the more the Lord hath taken away from me, as my husband, father, friends, sister, children, and all." The second collection of testimonies was made by Henry Walker, minister of an independent but Congregationalist congregation in London in the 1650s. Spiritual Experiences of Sundry Believers was published in 1652 in two editions, of which only the second edition seems to survive. The first edition contained 19 testimonies, and the second contained these and a further 42. So there were 61 altogether. And 26 are certainly by women. John Rogers gave the actual names of the people who were speaking the testimonies. Walker just gives the initials. So there were 26 women's testimonies, 19 men's, and the sex of the remaining speakers can't really be determined. And they were collected over a period of about a year, it seems. All of them have a similar form, but they vary in length considerably, from about 3 to about 40 pages. Each begins with an account of the speaker's earliest spiritual state. My sins have much grieved me, or I had very great temptations. And sometimes this is quite long, contains quite a lot of biographical information. And it's then followed by a statement that the speaker survived her tribulations through the comfort of God's promises. And these promises are often identified with particular biblical texts, such as, "Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled," and so on. Then the speaker goes on to say that she's experienced God's love, and gives what is referred to as testimonies of his spirit. And then she says that the speaker knows that God loves her. What's quite interesting is they avoid saying they're saved. Of those testimonies made by people whose sex can be determined, the women's are usually the fullest, with a considerable amount of detail about their childhoods, their education, and their own children. They don't very often mention their marriages or their husbands, and grief, or at least the description of grief, is spent much more freely over children than over spouses. But one of the important things one has to remember is that these women's lives were recounted only so far as they impinged upon their progress towards discovering God. They were especially aware of misfortunes being sent as punishments. I've already quoted to you the woman who said about 9 years ago at the birth of a child, "I had very great temptations of destroying myself." She goes on to say that the reason for this was my neglecting of duties, they being the ordinances of God. Another woman reported that when she was pregnant, the blackness of my spirit was such, with the burnings of my troubled and afflicted soul, that I could at that time take no comfort in anything, and had I not been with child, and affected with natural inclination to the babe in my womb, I had been in danger, had not God by some other means prevented me, to have destroyed myself. So you can see there's a considerable body of writing about women associating acute states of mental distress with pregnancy and childbirth. There are two other cases which I'm not going to say anything about because they are so utterly Protean in their form. They're what is described as green sickness of young girls and mother fits in older women. Both of these conditions were extensively described by physicians, but I have never found any account of a woman saying, "I had green sickness," or "I had mother fits," which I think is quite interesting. I want to just briefly say something about suicide and then talk a bit about religion before concluding. I mean, suicide is the tragic outcome of some depressive states. It was also a great sin against God. And in the 17th century England, it seems that about a third of reported suicides were women. We don't have any figures for attempted suicides. But in general, through the ages, men have shown themselves to be more successful in achieving death, and usually by more violent means. Tables produced in a recent work on suicide in early modern England suggest that yeomen's wives of all social classes were the group of married women most likely to commit suicide, and labourers' wives were the least likely to. But you have to take into account the fact that labourers' wives were of little interest to officialdom, so they may well have been underreported. The authors of this modern study didn't venture a view on whether unmarried women were more or less likely to commit suicide because of the difficulty they had with actually identifying unmarried women. But they did note that there were many younger suicides than today, that's to say people under the age of 25. I hope that what I've started to show you is that we do have accounts of women's states of mind, and not just accounts from elite women. But these accounts require careful consideration, because their purpose was not to reveal a set of symptoms to a physician or psychologist, but to demonstrate how an extreme state of mind had been settled by discovering God. All the descriptions of these extreme states of mind are couched in religious language. And for those afflicted, it was very unclear whether the answer was the attentions of a physician or a minister. So to wrap up, I want to just say one or two things about these considerations and contemporary depression. The incidence of many psychological disorders between men and women differs considerably. More men commit suicide than women. But a Dutch study of 2004 shows that there's a distinct difference, gender difference, in the incidence of generalized anxiety and depression, which this was a study of older men and women. Older women are much more prone to generalized anxiety and depression than older men. An English study of the 1960s found that women complained of mental illness more than men, but that the female rate was almost twice that of men, and that a disproportionate number were middle-aged. And I've emphasised how important the autobiographical accounts are. However, another modern study, has shown that individuals suffering from depression and other emotional disorders such as post-traumatic stress disorder have very great difficulty in being specific in autobiographical memory. So should we believe what these people say? I think another problem arises from the language that people have to use to describe extreme psychological states. I mean, since the 17th century, we've had the benefit of an entirely new psychological and psychiatric vocabulary. But what was created for professionals to describe states of mind, but this was all created for professionals to describe states of mind in others. It objectifies psychological conditions. I mean, nobody says, "I'm feeling psychotic." So what language do people today use to describe their most intense feelings? I have to say, I was rather surprised when I discovered an answer to this, which I'll tell you by means of an anecdote, which is my last point. A good many years ago, Miriam Stoppard used to have a television programme, and each programme took a different ailment, and there was a panel of experts and a studio audience. The studio audience would be made up of people who were recruited from the society for that illness, in the Parkinson's Society or the Multiple Sclerosis Society, or whatever it was. And the experts would be doctors and social workers and things. And on this occasion, there was a programme on postnatal depression and puerperal psychosis. The experts consisted of a psychiatrist who'd made a study of both conditions, a gynecologist, an obstetrician, a couple of other people, forget who they were, and me, because I'd written an article on women's psychological disorders. When the women in the audience began to talk about their experiences, and some of them had had very, very acute episodes of puerperal psychosis with hallucinations, almost to a woman, they used religious language. It seems to be the case that religion, for all that people don't go to church and many people don't profess to any religious beliefs, religion does still provide the best vocabulary we have for describing subjective states, especially if they're very severe. to conclude that I think the most heartening piece of knowledge I acquired that day was that both conditions, both puerperal psychosis and postnatal depression, do normally go away of their own accord. The piece of knowledge that I gave them, which was not quite so welcome, was that postnatal depression is not a product of the medicalisation of childbirth and impersonal hospital care, but has, as I hope I've shown you, a much longer history. I think I've probably offered you rather more questions than answers, but I think they draw attention to what a very interesting field of study this is and how it deserves the work that the project is putting into it. But also that there are sources that allow us to enter fragmentarily and temporarily, to be sure, into the mental worlds of women in the past.
Okay, we have time for some questions after that extremely interesting paper. But since there's usually a slight gap before anyone thinks of them, I'll make a couple of quick announcements. This is the third of the lectures in this series. The first two are now available as a podcast on our website, which is www.beforedepression.com. There are leaflets at the back which include this website address on it. And Anne should be available in a couple of weeks.
I think so.
Okay. There is another lecture coming up in the series in 2 weeks, which will be at Northumbria, if I can just remember who it is. Professor Anthony LaVopa, on revisiting the Boswells, marked politeness and melancholy in the Scottish Enlightenment. So that will be at Northumbria University in 2 weeks. The full lecture programme is available at the back if you want to pick one up, if you don't already have one. And one last announcement. There is a leaflet on everybody's seat which asks how you heard about this series. If you could please tick that, it's very useful to us to know where the audience is coming from for these things. And just leave them there and we'll pick them up at the end or put them on the table at the back. Okay, is that enough time for somebody to pick up a question? Yes, Susan, you want?
Yes, I'm afraid I'm
going
to take something on.
Because if people are asking me two questions at one, I might have to make a note of them. So, fair enough.
Right in the back.
Got the okay, thanks.
So, sorry. When you're talking about the women in the audience, the final part of your paper, and the language they were using to describe their conditions, you said that they were drawing on religious discourse, and I was wondering if you could give one or two examples if they come to mind.
I'm terribly sorry, it took place about 10 years ago that I did this. But, I mean, it was very, they would use, if you could switch that one.
Somebody, did they talk about being damned?
No, it was not so much to do with salvation, it was much more to do with ecstasy. And they would just, actually I do now remember the woman who was hallucinating. She said she got into these kind of ecstatic states, and the way in which she described them was very much like the kind of world of religious ecstasy. There was an element of punishment in the discourse. It was a very bizarre experience, I have to say.
Yes, but I just sort of, because what immediately struck me there is we have so much language around from the popular psychology, self-help, to describe these conditions, and we have so much. It seems to me, in popular magazines and women's magazines, which a colleague of mine did a study of, is that they actually feed this generalized anxiety, because men's magazines are all about whatever they're about, and women's magazines are about is your hug in the store. they just feed these worries. Which is a bit beside the point, but it just really surprised me that that we would still be drawing on this kind of discourse. I thought it was very interesting.
I mean, we're talking about people who, the particular instances were not people who just had mild postpartum depression. They were people who had really full-blown
puerperal psychosis. I mean, they were bonkers. They were completely. They said. I mean, that they said that they taught themselves very. I mean, they were people who'd come through it, and they were very eloquent about it. But I mean, they had no other language for describing something so intense.
So inaccessible, presumably, as well. It's the only way you can bridge that gap. When we talk about rain in biblical proportions, we don't mean a bit of a storm, we mean rain like you've never seen before. And I've just made a note to myself of that language. It is like the experience inaccessible in its magnitude. And perhaps religious expression is the only way you can bridge that gap. It's the only way, if you can't express it, you can at least express the magnitude of the experience. Is that something?
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. But also, of course, I mean, psychological language doesn't give you a language to describe feelings.
Yeah,
I think
a lot
of popular psychology probably does, and a lot of the self-help literature is really all about, a discourse for your own feelings and a discourse with yourself about your feelings. And I question the idea that it's the only way to have. That religion is the only discourse available to us to describe these intense states.
No, I wouldn't for one moment say it was the only way. I'm merely giving you an example that I came across.
Yeah.
Maureen, thank you.
Hello, Anne. I enjoyed that. It's a while since I read your paper on this, so forgive me if I'm asking a question that you have written about. I wanted to pick your brains. You initially, at one point, you were talking about physicians and their responses to these various psychotic states. Did you find at all, when you looked at this, there was any difference between the typical humoral physician and some of these rather rare creatures called chemical physicians? I mean, I had in mind the likes of Mary Try, who is the very rare thing, the female physician of the medicatrix.
Yes.
Did they have a different approach, or were they the same?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I don't know the medical literature well enough. I mean, as you know, the medical literature is huge. And, I mean, you could spend the rest of your life doing nothing else. So I have been a bit pick and mix in what I've looked at. And I'm sorry I can't answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask, first, Anne,
lovely,
but about religious communities and this idea of religious language, and Marjorie Kemp in the medieval period is perhaps one of the most famous examples of somebody who is seen as a holy woman, and people flock to her. And later we understand that she probably suffered from post-puerperal psychosis and postnatal depression. She had visions, she wailed and she wept, and it was seen as a mark of her holiness. Did this carry on into the early modern period, where kind of religious women, anchorites and hermits and things, seems less depressed and more holy and ecstatic and such
one? Well, I mean, I think anchorites were considered to be a bit passé by the 17th century. We're talking about the thrusting modern world of Cromwellian Puritanism. English Protestantism is a bit stiff upper lip. And it tended to be really only at the outer fringes that people got excited about visions and that kind of thing. I mean, I think they were considered to be a bit difficult to manage. And of course, by the early 18th century, there is beginning to be a real reaction against religious enthusiasm. I mean, you could say that this kind of the visions and so forth, that kind of impulse was deflected into things like the Quakers' demonstrations. I mean, there was, I've forgotten the name of the woman who walked naked down the corn market in Oxford for a sign, and then there was another woman who went to the to a sermon being preached by Peter Sterry, who was one of Cromwell's chaplains in Whitehall. And while he was preaching, she gradually took off her clothes one by one. So, I mean, there was quite a lot of kind of religious activity, but it was perhaps a little less interior.
Yeah. That's very interesting. In the descriptions you were saying, talking about it yesterday, the idea of being going and philosophy, and Aristotelian idea.
And Marjorie Kemper, apparently, at some point, was the Bishop of Lincoln, said that her problem was she was suffering from uterine suffocation because of her inability to express her seed. Which I thought was quite an interesting one, and yet she was, because she had just considered the kind of first person who had a spiritual autobiography, and I just found it interesting.
Well, the uterine suffocation, suffocation of the mother, mother fits, they're all, the same terms recur. They all had these rather peculiar, well, utterly different set of symptoms attached to them. They're kind of, they're used as a generalised diagnosis for women who've had children who are unwell in some way. There has been some work done on them. But, I mean, again, the problem is that every single description is different. But as I said, I've never come across a woman saying, "Oh, I had terrible mother fits." It's all the doctors saying it's about women.
You concentrated and write so on postpartum depression. Again, I'm going to sneak two questions in there. First of all, if I'm very cautious of not about your retrospective diagnosis, but my own propensity to do that. So do you think that is something that, if you could transpose that, that's something that they would recognise, or can you only see it through the religious framework? And the other half of that question is, have you ever come across, you talk about the modern study on, you know, early modern suicide, which does refer to suicides in older women. And is there, at the opposite end of the spectrum, writings on what we would now recognise as perhaps menopausal distress? And are there any correlations between the two? Because the modern study, I think you're referring to, does kind of sort of imply, but doesn't
The problem of identifying, I mean, menopausal is a kind of, I don't know, 19th, 20th century description. Mm. And, I mean, at this period, you're much more likely to have, the division is much more likely to be between sexually active women and other women.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's what I'm asking. I mean, we would now recognise some of these symptoms to be postnatal, which is a 20th century description, and, you know, menopausal is the same. And do the two experiences at all collide?
Well, I think probably if you looked at some of the symptoms, some of the descriptions of mother fits, you'd find flushes and a number of other things which were kind of fit into that set of symptoms, but they're fitting into a different framework. I think that's why. The first question was
just really about the nature of retrospective diagnosis. I mean,
can we
only view it through their eyes, or can we legitimately say, well, we now clearly recognise that?
I don't know. This is one of these things that, I mean, I've been working on the 17th century for about 35 years, and I kind of change my mind about, it depends a bit on what I've been working on, what I've been thinking about, whether I think this does represent something that I can transfer into modern terms, or other terms. I think, you know, this seems... Can I really put this there? History is very boring if you write it always surrounding it with caveats. And I mean, it's interesting to be able to say, well, I think these two are connected. And, you know, lots of human experience shares common characteristics. But I think it's more to do with the way in which one understands the kind of underlying philosophy of it.
Yeah.
I think it could also depend whether you're looking at a source written by a man or written by a woman.
I was interested in a discussion of the way that we conceptualise these disorders, and particularly the discussion at the beginning of the humoral theory.
About which you know much more than I do, Howard.
I doubt it too. But it occurs to me that the humoral theory implies that these disorders are bodily disorders rather than strictly mental disorders, if you can make that metaphysical distinction between the two substances. But they're things that you treat with diets, that you put different things in, you take different things out. And I'm asking myself, is there a proper conception of a mental, psychological disorder that isn't simply a corporeal disorder? And I was thinking about that when you go on to saying, well, sometimes they talk about it in religious terms, and sometimes they talk about it in medical terms. And I wonder if there's a genuine distinction there between a medical approach to what is a bodily disorder and a religious approach to what is a spiritual disorder. So that the two sets of vocabularies actually give you ways of talking about different kinds of concepts of disease that we brought there.
On the train coming up here, I was reading Mr. Schmidt's book on melancholy. I can't remember what his first name is.
Jeremy
Schmidt, which I was very convinced by, where he says that particularly in the early 17th century, you know, the disorder of the soul is not fundamentally different from the other disorders. And that the...
I'm too much of a Carthesian, I think.
Yes. And that the doctors will tend, the physicians will tend to bring in the soul, and the ministers will tend to bring in the body, and that somewhere in between them there emerges a kind of fusion. I mean, I think really and truly, I don't think I have a better answer. I mean, I also think it's something you've thought much more profoundly about than I have.
I'm sure there are other people in the room who've thought a lot more about than I have.
Any other questions?
This is really a question that we're just kind of wondering about over the years. But the historical approach to depression, I mean, have you encountered anything in your research that suggests, well, how old is depression? When did we evolve? When did we become sophisticated enough as mental machines to have depression? We're wondering if hunter-gatherer societies had any evidence that they became depressed.
This is like my father's in the habit of saying, what genetic advantage is... conferred by mathematical genius.
I just wondering.
I haven't a clue. I mean, at what stage?
Well, as far as we got here, was that presumably, in order to be depressed, you would have to worry about something, which means that you had to have the ability to plan ahead sufficiently to worry that your plan wouldn't work. But that might be a completely simplistic way of thinking about it.
Yes.
I just asked on the off chance if you had encountered anything.
No, I mean, I'm terribly I'm rather taken with Neanderthal beings. They who seem to be delightfully good-natured and well-behaved and unaggressive, and were kind of nobody's quite sure whether they actually interbred with what became humans or whether they died out. But that did be an interesting study to know whether they got depressed.
I go for materialist theory of the time. I learned from an archaeologist a long time ago. Agriculture means failure. You stay put and you watch your crops rot. So agriculture means starvation, failure. Hunting and gathering, you simply move 500 miles in a month and you go somewhere else. I suspect, I'm not able really to answer the question, but I think I I think agriculture means you see the consequence of your action, you can't do a damn thing about it.
Yes. And is this why the expulsion from Eden had such a...
I think so, yes. Hunter-gatherers are much richer in terms of their diet.
I think it also, but it also raises a lot of very interesting questions, I think, about human consciousness, which are actually really rather, extraordinarily difficult to answer, and potentially quite troubling as well.
If I just add to that, if you listen to the podcast of our first lecture by Alison Braben, who's a clinical psychologist, she talks a bit about this the advantages conferred by acquiring depression, if you like. That's the website.
Yeah, in our days we take for granted that that many marriages are unsuccessful. Marriage is not necessarily a great institution for women, that many women do not want to have children. Many women perhaps have no natural aptitude to be mothers. I was wondering, in the talk that you gave, you didn't really mention women thinking about the institution of marriage or about motherhood in general. You did mention one woman who stood up in church and said she was unhappy because of her husband. That was a very daring thing to do. But is there a coming together of women expressing a sense of their own personal unhappiness and also protesting about the nature of their marital condition or the fact of their being mothers?
No, I think. I think there are two elements to this. The first is there were a lot of things they could do nothing about. There was no divorce. England was unique amongst the Protestant countries of Northwest Europe in not introducing divorce at the Reformation. And one of the pieces of evidence that I think that stands very strongly about the inefficacy of birth control is that so many women speak of their terrors of having further children when they knew they were likely to die. So there's a category of things they can do nothing about. I think Protestantism did provide them with a language and a forum for speaking about these things, often I think perhaps in rather punitive terms, but in their attempts to explore the way in which God worked out his purposes, which is after all what the purpose of spiritual autobiography is, they discovered a language and a mode of expression which I think hadn't really been seen before, which of course leads ultimately to the novel.
If there's one last question, we'll take it, otherwise we'll conclude. Okay, can I just thank Anne again for the extremely interesting question. I would like everybody, if you could, to tick off that link that we do find it very helpful indeed. And if you want details of the lectures, there's a stack of links at the back.
Can I just ask, if you have a class
that we check, can you put it at the back? All right.